All right, we will try this again. All right, so the conference theme actually is, it's not business as usual. When it comes to the subject of Israel, it's not business as usual. And what I mean by that is actually in three different ways I see it as not being business as usual. And that is that first, from the perspective of the church, you know, the church has, well, let me put it this way. Prior to Jesus' coming, the understanding of God, the knowledge of God was primarily contained within the nation and the people of Israel. There was about a 2,000-year period of time where that was the case. God's plan was always for the message to go to the entire world. But there was this 2,000-year period of time that in a sense, that period ended when Jesus came. Well, there's been this 2,000-year period of time since Jesus that for the most part, through most of that 2,000 years, the understanding, the knowledge of God has been primarily within the non-Jewish, the Gentile community, until this last 100 years. And that's a significant change. And we're actually entering, we're heading into an age that has been prophesied in the scriptures, and it's not like the last 2,000 years. And it's not like the 2,000 years before that.
Right.
So it's something new, something, a further fulfillment of God's plan for the kingdom of God and for the universe. Secondly, it's not really business as usual, even in terms of our understanding of ministry and missionary activity. Because in a sense, the gospel has gone to the rest of the nations. And by the way, the word nations in the Hebrew basically means Gentiles or nations. Whereas Israel is Israel, and then there are the nations. And so the gospel, we've sent out missionaries to the nations. What about when Israel comes back in? See, it's a little different. It's not missions and it's not ministry exactly as usual. Okay, and then thirdly, it's even not even business as usual. Because I think one of the things that some of us have a sense of is that even someplace where, in a sense, that God is showing up, you know, we can even see some things in Hollywood and in movies that are, there's more of the gospel being presented in some circles than, you know, there's more Christian movies out now, you know, that have some pretty strong messages. And they're getting in the public theaters. It's not the usual place of getting the message out in the four walls of the church. So it's not business as usual in reference to Israel and how even Israel is going to, how this is going to happen, the prophetic promises in terms of Israel. JD asked me the question earlier, how did this concept of the Israel Conference come about? And basically, it started really with Deb and I taking our first joint trip to Israel in May. We spent 3 weeks in Israel. We'll show some pictures, Lord willing, tomorrow. Some things worked in our hearts, and we're going to share some of that tomorrow. I know I'm probably going to say tomorrow a lot because we can't share everything tonight. But one of the things that happened is after we came back, Terry and Annette asked us, you know, to share something about our trip. And so about 3 or 4 weeks after we got back, we shared here on a Sunday morning. And we had felt strongly that some things that we had kind of turned over in our hearts while we were there, we weren't quite ready to share. So what we did on that Sunday morning was we actually shared just some general information about Israel, having traveled the land while we were there. And our impression was people were quite interested in that. And that was kind of a what and a who and a where of Israel. And that's kind of what we're doing tonight. We're actually doing sort of a little bit of a repeat of what we shared that one Sunday morning at Agape, which is where, what, who when it comes to Israel. By the way, just as a piece of information, The word Israel actually shows up in the scriptures about 2,222 times. Okay, it's not a small topic. And the percentage of it showing up doesn't disappear in the New Testament. It shows up 2,000, depends on how you put it in the searches, but about 2,200 times. It's not a small topic. The first question is, where is Israel? All right, so let's see if this technically will work. We're doing it here. All right. So where in the world is Israel? Should I go left, right, up, down? I should go to the right. All right. Keep going. Isn't that cool? That's good old Google. Keep going. Getting there? Keep going. All right, where is Israel? There's the... Let's move back just for a moment, okay? All right. You guys see the blue dot? That's Chicago, all right? And you can see the... If you've got good eyes, you can see the WI above that and the MI next to it. Here, I'll go slightly larger. So you can even see Chicago. You can see the word Chicago up there, if you got good eyes. All right. Well, sorry, but... All right. Let's go back right. All right. Ooh, actually, enlarging it, we actually have Israel. You see it there? All right. Are you straining your eyes to see it? Let's go a little larger. Still got it up here. There we go. All right, can you see it there? Still pretty small, isn't it? Yeah. We got to go even bigger. All right, now can you see it? Yeah. Why do you think you can barely see it? Because it is small. Okay, it is so small. We used to have a pointer here someplace. Oh, yeah. So here is Israel. All right. And so how big? So, all right, first of all, Israel is in what's known as the Middle East, and it is surrounded by primarily Arab Muslim countries. And maybe some people remember, can anybody tell me the approximate size of Israel? Any type of comparison? It's smaller than Illinois. Delaware, actually, it's bigger than Delaware, actually. It's actually about the size of New Jersey, okay? And actually, if we go back to the PowerPoint, there is, on the left-hand side is Lake Michigan, and on the right is Israel, and those are to scale. All right, you can actually fit all of Israel in Lake Michigan. Okay, it is not very big. Okay, and that, we'll get to this in a moment, but let me give you another perspective. Let's go back up here. You see those black lines I put on the left-hand side? Well, that's the one that goes horizontally. is Milwaukee to Madison. And that's the widest point of Israel, is Madison to Milwaukee. Widest point. Okay. Not even, not to go. Well, I guess 2 hours. Yeah, Madison, Milwaukee. Yeah, that's right. That's about an hour. So from here to here is about the same distance as from Madison to Milwaukee. The north-south is from coming from the south suburbs of Chicago and going slightly north of Green Bay. And that's the longest point. That's from a lot, which is in the Red Sea down here, bottom of Israel, all the way up here to Metula, which is on the Lebanese border. Basically driving like from Chicago to Green Bay. That is and that's, again, the furthest north to south of the country. Yeah, and it's not, well, now it is pretty much superhighways. Well, no, actually it's right here. From here to the Red Sea, it's basically two lanes. It's not a huge big road. It's sort of a little bit like, maybe it's four lanes in some places, but I think it was two lanes most of the way, wasn't it? Between a lot and the Red Sea? Because it's through the desert. See, this is the other point. If you actually draw a line here across here, this is all the Negev. This is all desert. Okay. All right. Which is like more than, it's about half of the state of Israel. Okay. And let's go a little further here. Okay, because the picture on the right is Israel including the West Bank. Here is Israel without the West Bank. Okay, you've already got this tiny country that is half desert, and you take out the West Bank, and you're actually decreasing the size of Israel even further. Okay, that is internationally recognized Israel's borders. Okay, it's a small country. Here's a scripture from Deuteronomy, chapter 7, verse 6 through 8. For you are a holy people to the Lord your God. The Lord your God has chosen you to be a people for himself, a special treasure above all the peoples on the face of the earth. The Lord did not set his love on you, nor choose you because you were more in number than any other people. For you were the least of all peoples. But because the Lord loves you and because you would keep the oath which he swore to your fathers, the Lord has brought you out with a mighty hand and redeemed you from the house of bondage, from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So from back in Moses' day, the promises to Israel was not that they'd be a major nation. Okay, at least in fact, something I was, actually I have a little video to show you a little later, and it talks about the size of Israel, even talks about how Israel is smaller than El Salvador, which is a small South American country. Israel is small, and yet it gets this world attention. And then from the New Testament, from 1 Corinthians chapter 1, for you see your calling, brethren, that not many wise according to the flesh, not many mighty, not many noble are called, but God has chosen the foolish things of the world to put to shame the wise. And God has chosen the weak things of the world to put to shame the things which are mighty. And the base things of the world and the things which are despised, God has chosen, and the things which are not, to bring to nothing the things that are, that no flesh should glory in his presence. But of him you are in Christ Jesus, who became for us wisdom from God and righteousness and sanctification and redemption, that as it is written, he who glories, let him glory in the Lord. As Sister Annette was referring to something else, but not to despise small things. And Israel is a small thing, and how God works through small things is part of his plan. When we are weak, he is strong. Israel defies, and that's maybe not the right word in a certain way, but it defies the natural mind. In many ways, really, it should not exist. In fact, one of the challenges tonight in terms of talking about where and who and what Israel is, even just, I would actually say in some ways, this is the least scriptural, and I'm doing verses, but of the three sessions, I'm talking very physically, very representative demographically of Israel tonight. And it is, even on that level, it's amazing that Israel exists. I gave you out a handout that talks about Israel's history in the last 500 years. Do you have a question, Leah? Oh, it here, I'll show you. That's a good question.
Is it because the world is no,
it's because it is actually the west bank of the Jordan River. The Jordan River actually runs, that boundary is pretty much where the Jordan River is. The east bank of the Jordan, I'm sorry.
I understand. Yeah.
Right. It's the west bank. Actually, the east bank of the Jordan is actually in the Jordan, is in what's modern-day Jordan. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Good question, though. Yes?
So, I'm sorry, because I'm attracted to it, but do you want to explain why you took out the west bank?
Yeah, I think I'm going there.
Okay.
Well, sort of. I was talking about the history that I gave out, and it's actually, that came off of actually an Israeli government site, the Ministry of Affairs or something from Israel. And it actually goes all the way back to biblical times, but I just did the last, since 1500. And actually, really, what it gets really, where it's most interesting is really in the last 100 years. We're talking 150 years. But my understanding is that if you look at some of the, and we're going to look at Ezekiel chapter 36 tomorrow, which talks about the physical return of the Jewish people to Israel. Now let's go back a little further. So in 70 AD and in 125 AD, Rome crushed two rebellions by the Jewish people against Roman authority. And between those two defeats of the Jewish people, Rome actually took the Jewish people and dispersed them throughout their empire. It's called the diaspora, the spreading of the Jewish people. They took them out of Israel and spread the Jewish people throughout the whole world. The diaspora, okay? And I'm not sure exactly where the word comes from. But it's the spreading of, and actually, Jews in America are still in the diaspora because they are still outside of Israel. But Rome actually took the Jewish people that were in Israel and scattered them in their empire because they did not want to have any more rebellions by the Jewish people in the Middle East. And so, it probably has the root in it, yes. So the Jewish people were scattered throughout the whole world, physically taken out of their homeland and scattered throughout the whole world. And even some of the best-known Bible scholars of like 1500 to 1700, when they looked at passages like Ezekiel in the scriptures, they looked at them as kind of allegorical, not necessarily literally, that somehow the Jewish people would return and have their own land back in the Middle East. Even prior to World War I, Theodor Herzl, who's considered the father of modern Zionism, went before the Kaiser of Germany, went before the Sultan of the Ottoman Empire, and talked about could there be a Jewish state in the Middle East. And they basically laughed at his face. I mean, I don't think it was exactly spitefully, but it was like, what do you mean? The Jews haven't had this land in 2,000 years. You can't take it back after 2,000 years. It just didn't sound like something that was going to happen. And not that really the land was very populated, and nobody had grown anything there for years. And yet, in 1917, one of the things that happened in 1917, interesting, and an interesting article to pull up. I did not bring it for tonight. But during World War I, and you know, one of the things I like about history is that it's his story. And in World War I, one of the things from a biblical standpoint that sometimes we might miss, and I don't want to diminish the fighting that was in Europe, but from a historical perspective, we always think about the fighting that was in France during World War I and the huge number of armies and the huge number of casualties that happened in World War I, primarily in France, between the German forces, the French and the British, and then later on the Americans. But there were battles and fighting. It was a world war. There were other things that happened all over the world that sometimes are looked at as sideshows to what happened in Europe. One of those sideshows was that, you know, one of the Ottoman Empire was allied with the Central Powers, Germany and Austria-Hungary. And the Ottoman Empire had controlled the Middle East, had controlled Jerusalem and what is Israel since 1500. And in World War II, the British battling the Ottomans took Israel, this little strip of land, from the Ottomans. And the British general named Allenby, when he went into Jerusalem, he actually had a sense that something was happening of biblical proportions. Because what happened in 1917 when Allenby took Jerusalem was Jerusalem was no longer in Muslim hands. And I think Allenby was at least somewhat of a Christian, and so Israel was falling back into some level of faith hands. And that happened in 1917. Around the same time, the British government, now with control in that area, actually had what was known as the Balfour Declaration, which was a document in Britain that actually recognized the right for the Jewish people to return to this land in the Middle East. That happened in 1917. That's 101 years ago. Think about it. In 101 years ago, that was not a nation. That tiny little strip of land was not a nation. There was no nation. No, there was no other people group living in that land as a nation. And actually, it was pretty desolate for the most part. There were some Bedouin Arabs living there. There were a couple other indigenous smaller groups. But a lot of the land was not very populated. It was not, nobody was growing anything. But there was this beginning of this push for Jews to return back to the land. One of the places that Deb and I visited is in in the Galilee, where there's this one of the earlier pioneer villages that's in the Galilee. Knesset. And one of the things that happened there is that these European Jews in 1908 came into the Galilee region and they wanted to farm. And they came in and the Arabs living in the area kind of laughed at them. Not maliciously, but basically nobody's grown anything here for thousands of years. Nobody grows anything here. And so they tried, they planted things, and actually they weren't very successful. In fact, some of those early pioneers in that group that came in 1908 actually were so disappointed by their crops, they actually committed suicide. But then the next group that came in looked at what that first group did and said, those things didn't work, so let's try these things. And so the second group was actually more successful in planting things than the first group. But there's a bit, I think there's a little bit of a spiritual principle here. So was the first group successful? They actually set the stage, because if they didn't try certain things, the second group wouldn't have known. And I will show pictures tomorrow, but there's a black and white picture, if you go on these grounds, of what it looked like in 1908. And then to compare it with what it looks like today is just amazing. So then in after World War II, after the Holocaust, more Jews returned to Israel, and it's not even that period of time is not a pretty picture. Because even though Britain had done and had the Balfour Declaration, they actually pulled back somewhat. And I think part of the reason, and this is, you know, when we look at 1 Corinthians chapter 1, is then we look at the Middle East, and what's in the Middle East that's economically important? Oil. When did we start using all our automobiles, like, all the time? After World War II. and so the world interest in this region increased, and Britain was actually more reluctant to give up Israel. And without going into detailed history here, well, one of the things that happened is that there were Jews that were leaving Europe that had survived the Holocaust, and the British limited the number of Jews that could actually go back into Palestine, and they actually turned away some ships. There was at least one that actually sank in the Mediterranean because the British turned them away. Full of people, yes. In 1947... the UN, which was a new organization, actually met. One of their first major decisions was the 1947 UN plan concerning Israel, which was to divide the region into two countries, an Arab state and a Jewish state. Now, I'm not sure where to go from there. Because even there were Jewish leaders that were even interviewed by the UN who said, I don't think it will work, but we won't vote against it. The country's so small, you know, and to try to divide it up into two governmental regions is, and the interchange within the land, and actually, at least since 1908 and the early part of the century, for the most part, the Arab and the Jewish communities in the land were so connected, and they work with each other. And actually, if you look carefully at the history between World War II and 1948, it's almost the bigger powers and the British that started to put pressure on the Arabs not to negotiate with this beginning new country. It's always interesting. The big powers sometimes put their hands in things and actually make it tougher for the little guy, so to speak. And so pressure started to be put, and really I think the way to put it is that the British could have put more pressure on the Arabs to truly negotiate. But what actually happened was the Arab leaders just basically said, we're not going to cooperate at all. And even though the UN agreed to form two separate states, the Arab leaders said, no, we won't agree to this. And so when Israel declared its independence, armies from Egypt, this little country over here, from Lebanon, this legitimately small country, from Jordan, this small country, from Syria, from Iraq, and Saudi Arabia all sent troops to attack Israel and eliminate Israel. But God has chosen the foolish things in the world to confound the wise. Nobody thought that Israel would survive. And actually, if we go back to one of these previous pictures, this one, the UN partition for Israel was even smaller than this. Okay, I don't have a map of it, but it was even smaller. Okay, Israel in 1948, actually, because they defeated the Arab armies that attacked, they actually gained some territory, okay, which was actually recognized. Nobody really, for the most part, the world community recognized these boundaries in 1948 after that war was over. The other thing that happened that's so significant in 1948 is the beginning of the Palestinians. And what I mean by that is, and people ask the questions about the Palestinians. Within Israel itself, within this territory, there is about 35% of the population is Arab. And those Arabs are citizens, full citizens of the nation of Israel. When Israel was established in 48, it was a democratic, pluralistic society. In other words, if you lived in Israel, regardless of what your religion was, what your culture was, you were a citizen. And so those Arabs living within this territory became citizens, and they vote. In fact, they are not asked to join the military because they know that there could be mixed allegiances. There are some smaller Arab groups like the Druze who don't have a problem joining the military. But Israel didn't even, you can say, said they could be citizens, you can vote, you can serve in the Knesset, you do not have to enter the army because we don't want you to have a conflict there. But that's what Israel did. Now, that was the government they were setting up in 1948. These Arab nations that were invading Israel said to the Arabs living in this territory, get out, join us, you'll eventually get your homes back. So some Arabs left this territory, joined with the invading armies, but the invading armies didn't win. So now these people lost their homes. They became refugees in camps in Syria and in Jordan and in Egypt, and those countries never really resettled them, which most of the time when there's refugees from a war, eventually the country that they're in resettles them. But it became political wild card, in a sense. And that's pretty much what, and then you have these people, and what happened is the West Bank, which is that empty space there up there on the map, was where a lot of them went. Now, it was controlled by Jordan from 1948 to 1967. Jordan did not make these people citizens for 20 years. Okay, but it was controlled by Jordan for those 20 years. Okay, another thing that happened during that period of time is that Jerusalem, which, and the Old City in particular, okay, the Old City of Jerusalem is technically it's right on the border between West Jerusalem and East Jerusalem. And East Jerusalem is primarily Arab. West Jerusalem has a higher Jewish population. The Old City is right on the border. And I may show some pictures later. But the Old City was always an issue in the negotiations because it's in a sense, holy to three faiths. And the original plan was for all the groups to have access to the Old City. There's a Jewish quarter, there is a Muslim quarter, there's an Armenian quarter, and a Christian quarter. Well, when the Jordanian armies and the Arab armies came into the Jerusalem in 1948, they sacked the Jewish quarter. It actually became the garbage dump of the Old City. Jordan did not guarantee or allow the plurality in the Old City. So that was from 1948 to 1967. So again, Jordan didn't do anything for the West Bank during those 20 years. They did not maintain the international flavor in the old city. So we go to 1967, and in 1967, Egypt's leader, Nasser, he mobilized his armies and put them on the border. Let's go to the next picture. Down here. He massed his armies on the border of Israel. Syria was also mobilizing their armies. And one of the things Nasser said is, we're going to destroy Israel. We're going to wipe them off the map. And Israel did not wait to be attacked. At this point, we're talking jet aircraft. We're talking about missiles. We're talking about modern warfare. And Israel was not going to wait for these big nations to attack them. And so Israel preempted and destroyed the Egyptian and the Syrian air forces on the ground. and in that war, they took the West Bank. Oh, let me go back to the West Bank. Jordan was always a little bit more moderate than the other Arab nations at this point. But Israel, when they made their preemptive strike through back channels, because at this point Israel has no official negotiations with any of these countries, but Israel sent messages to the king of Jordan, please stay out of this. We don't want to fight you. Stay out of this. Well, after the first 2 days or 3 days of fighting, the Jordanians sent troops into Israel. Israel responded by actually defeating the Jordanians in Jerusalem and taking the old city and taking the West Bank. Only after Jordan attacked Israel and joined in the fight. Point being, Israel is not perfect. There are definite issues, and we're going to get to some of that again with that word tomorrow. but Israel has not looked to be the aggressor. That's where Israel took the West Bank, why the West Bank is significant. I'll open it just for questions in the West Bank before I go any further. The West Bank has a mixture in it. One of the other things is there's the West Bank and there's Gaza, which you'll hear in the news. Gaza's tiny, but it's very populated. Gaza is right here. The tiny little strip right along here. Actually, you can see the word strip right here. It's right here is where Gaza is. One of the things is that Gaza actually, somebody said this to me many years ago, and I think I can't quite shake it. It's the Philistines. Israel never defeated the Philistines. And that's basically where the Philistines were. And it's still a thorn in Israel's side. I don't want to be unsympathetic. And Jesus obviously loves all. And how he's going to work that out, I do not know exactly. But Hamas, which controls the West Bank, I'm sorry, controls Gaza, is much more radical and it's really no negotiating with them. West Bank, which since the 1990s peace accords, is a bit more moderate. And I say a bit more. It's a complicated issue. But it is... A lot of it, well, I think there's two sides of it. One, from at least at this point, one of it is how the big powers have been involved. And oil plays such a big factor. If Israel was almost any place else in the world, I think the big powers would stay out of it more. And it would actually be, there'd be less pressure on Israel. And there'd be, I think that, that and I, Israel's a democracy, it's a pluralistic society, and yet it's pushed with standards in terms of how to deal with people that attack it like almost no other nation is. And that's because of where it's located. I think it's also a spiritual battle. But that doesn't mean that there aren't other issues, and that's we're really going to talk about that a little bit more tomorrow, which was one of the things that has turned over in our hearts. The other thing I want to talk about was who Israel. Because sometimes we talk about who and who are the Jews. Very simplistic definition that basically the Jews are descendant, physical descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. The word Israel comes from Jacob battling, fighting with, wrestling with God. And God changed his name from Jacob to Israel. Israel meaning struggle with God. And then you have the 12 tribes. You have the story of Joseph. You have the story of the Exodus. You have this term, the Jewish people, which basically comes from the word Judah, which was the southern kingdom in the days of the kings. It was the kingdom that survived longer because the northern kingdom was in some ways more decadent and eventually was carried captive by Assyria. And the southern kingdom was primarily the tribe of Judah. And the northern tribes which were carried captive in 400 BC, don't quote me on that, but when they were carried captive by Assyria, the ancient kingdom of Assyria, they, in terms of a discernible culture and people, they basically disappeared. And then we could use the term the lost tribes of the lost tribes of Israel. The southern kingdom, which was Judah, and some of Benjamin, and also because of the temple service, also had the Levites. And so Judah survived longer. It was, and so the term Jew pretty much comes from the word Judah. And most of modern Jewish community, if they can trace their roots, it's either to Judah, to Levi, or to Benjamin. Because that's the southern kingdom that basically survived. So that's kind of how the word Jew came about. Now people will argue, is a Jew, is it a religious thing? Is it a cultural thing, et cetera, et cetera? Well, there's an expression in the Jewish community that if you have 10 different Jews in the same room, you will have 11 different opinions. And I think on this topic of who is a Jew, I think that can be true as well. But I think that the simple definition of being descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob is really the biblical understanding and most likely through the tribe of Judah. Okay, so that's the who of Israel. We've talked about the what and the where. I think what I'd like to do before we break for our oneg tonight, just interesting about the Jewish forces at the invasion in 1948. Sources disagree about the amount of arms at the yeshiv's disposal at the ends of the mandate. But there was roughly one weapon for every three fighters in Israel. Okay, by the end of the war, they had managed to accumulate 20,000 rifles for the 35,000 soldiers who existed on paper, versus what the Arab countries had, between 23,000, 26,000 forces from all those countries. And they had been trained by the British and the French. Another piece of interesting history about the British, and I can almost sound anti-British, but actually Britain really, if you look at the history in those years, kind of pulled a carpet under. According to the mandate, the UN decision in 1947, when Britain was to leave, they had a number of military bases in Palestine and Israel. And basically the regions that were supposed to go to the Jewish community, their forts, their military installations in those areas were to go into Jewish hands. The ones that were in the West Bank and in the areas that would go to the Arab state were to go to Arab leaders. Every single British base went into Arab hands. They gave it to them. They just turned it over to them. They didn't turn it over. It's really miraculous. There is a documentary series that was done, not a Christian source. It was done called Against All Odds, if you ever look it up. It was actually done by a secular investigative reporter. And it talks about some of the history with the different wars that Israel has fought and reports of things happening that just don't make sense. It's almost like there's this historical evidence that God has done something. Just interesting stories. Interviewed some Jordanian troops that fought in one of the war, and they actually had left because they saw a vision of Abraham saying, no, don't come any closer. Something like that. I mean, just these, you know, and again, it's not done by a Christian or a rabbinic source. It's done by an investigative reporter. There are these reports of things that have happened. What's that? The name Against All Odds. Yeah, it's a DVD series. Yes, he was a well-known journalist that did this. And the Jordanians never resettled them. The Egyptians never resettled them. And to add to this, twice since 1990, when Israel made peace under President Clinton with the PLO, twice since then, Israel has actually agreed to resettle some of them in Israel. Actually, a relatively large number. Israel has gone often, at least from a secular standpoint, an extra mile, and said, yes, we will resettle them. We'll resettle. Plus money.
A lot of money.
And the Palestinian Authority and the Arab countries have said no. I think in many ways, yes. If I can go back historically a little bit further, Israel has... Where did I put the pointer? Okay. You know, when I was growing up, so in the early 1970s, here is Israel, here, and then all of its neighbors. Israel had not a single peace agreement with any of its neighbors. None of them. Now, Israel had existed for 20 or 30 years, but had no peace agreement. If you wanted to fly, if you wanted to visit Egypt from Israel, you had to fly from Israel to Germany or Greece or someplace else and then fly to Egypt because there was no commerce between them. Okay. Just happened this past year. And it's interesting because there's some things happening in Saudi Arabia that are quite interesting. I know I'm jumping around a little bit. Saudi Arabia gave Air India permission to fly over Saudi Arabia in order to fly to Israel. That just in the last year, somewhere in 2018. Okay. So in early 1970s, none had a peace agreement. In 1975, 1976, Anwar Sadat, the leader of Egypt, said, I want peace. And Israel made peace with Anwar Sadat. And in that, Israel had taken the entire Sinai during 1967 from Egypt. So the Sinai is bigger than the state of Israel. In order to make that peace agreement with Egypt, Israel gave the entire Sinai back to Egypt. Egypt wanted peace, and Israel made peace with Egypt. And I think I'm going to go ahead and show this next video. And I have to give a little bit of a disclaimer with this video. But it just fits here. Because I think it articulates it well. Again, this is from somewhat of a secular standpoint, but I think it's well articulated. I think it's a little bit strong in some ways, I say that. And I think tomorrow night when Deb and I share a little bit about what's going on in our own hearts from our trip in Israel, you know, God views things different than the world, you know. And, you know, like this parable of the Good Samaritan, you know, that's not worldly wisdom, okay? But again, tonight I'm trying somewhat, staying on the demographic, historical, from a historical, journalistic view of the Middle East. The sides have been drawn pretty clearly, and in some ways, when you look at the history from this perspective, Israel has stood against all these odds. And so I'm going to show this video, and again, I'm giving a little bit of a disclaimer. But I think it says some things pretty succinctly. Wait a minute, stop. Technical difficulties. Sorry.
When in fact, it is probably the easiest conflict in the world to explain. It may be the hardest to solve, but it is the easiest to explain. In a nutshell, it's this. One side wants the other side dead. Israel wants to exist as a Jewish state and to live in peace. Israel also recognizes the right of Palestinians to have their own state and to live in peace. The problem, however, is that most Palestinians and many other Muslims and Arabs do not recognize the right of the Jewish state of Israel to exist. This has been true since 1947, when the United Nations voted to divide the land called Palestine into a Jewish state and an Arab state. The Jews accepted the United Nations partition, but no Arab or any other Muslim country accepted it. When British rule ended on May 15, 1948, the armies of all the neighboring Arab states, Lebanon, Syria, Iraq, Transjordan, and Egypt, attacked the one-day-old state of Israel in order to destroy it. But to the world's surprise, the little Jewish state survived. Then it happened again. In 1967, the dictator of Egypt, Gamal Abdel Nasser, announced his plan, in his words, to destroy Israel. He placed Egyptian troops on Israel's border, and armies of surrounding Arab countries were also mobilized to attack. However, Israel preemptively attacked Egypt and Syria. Israel did not attack Jordan and begged Jordan's king not to join the war. But he did. And only because of that did Israel take control of Jordanian land, specifically the West Bank of the Jordan River. Shortly after the war, the Arab states went to Khartoum, Sudan, and announced their famous three no's: no recognition, no peace, and no negotiations. What was Israel supposed to do? Well, one thing Israel did a little more than a decade later in 1978 was to give the entire Sinai Peninsula, an area of land bigger than Israel itself and with oil, back to Egypt, because Egypt, under new leadership, signed a peace agreement with Israel. So Israel gave land for the promise of peace with Egypt and it has always been willing to do the same thing with the Palestinians. All the Palestinians have ever had to do is recognize Israel as a Jewish state and promise to live in peace with it. But when Israel has proposed trading land for peace, as it did in 2000, when it agreed to give the Palestinians a sovereign state in more than 95% of the West Bank and all of Gaza, the Palestinian leadership rejected the offer and instead responded by sending waves of suicide terrorists into Israel. Meanwhile, Palestinian radio, television, and school curricula remain filled with glorification of terrorists, demonization of Jews, and the daily repeated message that Israel should cease to exist. So it's not hard to explain the Middle East dispute. One side wants the other dead. The motto of Hamas, the Palestinian rulers of Gaza, is, "We love death as much as the Jews love life." There are 22 Arab states in the world, stretching from the Atlantic Ocean to the Indian Ocean. There is one Jewish state in the world, and it is about the size of New Jersey. In fact, tiny El Salvador is larger than Israel. Finally, think about these two questions. If tomorrow Israel laid down its arms and announced, "We will fight no more," what would happen? And if the Arab countries around Israel laid down their arms and announced, "We will fight no more," what would happen? In the first case, there would be an immediate destruction of the state of Israel and mass murder of its Jewish population. In the second case, there would be peace the next day. As I said at the outset, it is a simple problem to describe. One side wants the other dead. And if it didn't, there would be peace. Please remember this. There has never been a state in the geographic area known as Palestine that was not Jewish. Israel is the third Jewish state to exist in that area. There was never an Arab state, never a Palestinian state, never a Muslim or any other state. That's the issue. Why can't the one Jewish state the size of El Salvador be allowed to exist? That is the Middle East problem. I'm Dennis Prager.
Pretty heavy stuff. It puts it somewhat succinctly and maybe too simplistically in many ways, but and again, it's often it's the leadership more than the person on the ground. Because when you go through Israel, I mean, you see Arabs and Jews interacting on a daily basis. And that's been the case. But there are these agreements, and somehow, see, I think part of the problem is that when this, from a, again, I'm talking more from a political, pragmatic standpoint than a spiritual standpoint. When Anwar Sadat made peace with Israel, he wanted peace. It was sincere. It was not. He did not want to fight anymore. I do not know that was the case with Yasser Arafat when the Palestinians made peace in the 1990s. I think it's a very tenuous peace. And I'm for surely with Hamas and Gaza. Gaza has no... Hamas is not at all... doesn't hold any punches. They have no interest in negotiation whatsoever. They want to see Israel off the map. The West Bank, the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, I think is more of a mixed bag. I think they have... But I think that, you know, to some degree, again, I think Israel recognized in 1976 that Sadat was sincere. And I mean, Israel just gave back the entire Sinai. But there has to be two parties that are completely sincere in wanting peace. And I think there has been a problem in that in that regard. But there are some spiritual issues. And it's interesting because God may have to work out the spiritual issues before the political issues are resolved. And I think I will touch on this and then we'll close, because it does touch on something for tomorrow. Deb and I both heard, when we were in Israel, we heard two messages on the opposite perspective, Christian's perspective on this issue. And that is that, you know, biblically, there needs to be a reconciliation between Hagar and Sarah. And there needs to be a reconciliation between Esau and Jacob. Those are spiritually deep things. And in the understanding there spiritually, if I can put it this way, is that to whom much is given, much is required. And so in terms of the light that falls on the Jewish people, especially those in Messiah, there is something that has to work out there. I mean, I know God has touched our hearts. I have a different perspective from my trip this year in May. And as much as I can see this historically and from a pragmatic view, I also am touched by those messages in the scripture, that understanding from the scripture about reconciliation between Sarah and Hagar and between Esau and Jacob. So we have, yes, JD, do you have a?
So if the Arab nations decide to attack Israel again, where would side would Egypt fall on?
I think right now Egypt would stay out. I mean, the thing is that Israel's issue now is not so much the bigger nations, because Jordan and Egypt have both made peace with Israel. And I think they're both happy with the peace agreement. You know, Egypt does not like Hamas, and Egypt does not like having to have... Egypt's been pretty cooperative with Israel over it. So I think the peace agreements between Jordan and Egypt are... You know, they're not ideal, but they're workable. And Syria is too much in their own civil war problems. The problem is really with the Palestinians and the Arab backing of the Palestinians. And I think it's actually almost become more complicated than it was. Because, you know, and this is true for us even in the church, if we have external persecution, you know, if tomorrow there started to be persecutions of the church from outside of the church, we would be able to unite and deal with it. But if there's fighting inside the church, or inside our communities, it's more difficult. It becomes more difficult to deal with. And I think that's one of the issues that Israel's dealing with. When it was the foreign nations attacking them, like Jordan and Egypt and Syria, as horrible as that was, it was one thing. But now they have people that are within, although the map's not up there anymore, but they have people within the West Bank and Israel and Gaza that are the belligerent forces. So now it becomes more difficult. That's really what you're describing in Gaza. You really, and that's another complex issue here, is that Gaza and the West Bank are very different from each other, even because historically they're two different people groups. And in fact, there are many people that live in Gaza who have never been to the West Bank, don't know people. They're not, and yet this plan in terms of the UN was to for these to be part of the same nation. And it's and you have a more moderate faction in the West Bank. You have a much more radical. And it's really in Gaza that Gaza has is where there's the most legitimate suffering. But part of that is that you actually have a terrorist organization running it that doesn't want to make peace. Israel closes the borders. They lose out on trade and sources. And even sometimes the humanitarian aid doesn't get into them. You know, and then Israel opens it up and they shoot rockets at Israel. So it's, in fact, one of the interesting things about Gaza is that when, and here's part of the other problem, and you know, you have, it's just, the problems are multitudinous. Israel made the decision on its own to turn over control of Gaza in 2003 or something. President George W. Bush was president at the time. Israel turned it over. They were just tired of policing it, basically. But when they turned it over, Israel in the northern part of Gaza had these world-renowned hothouses that produced oranges that they shipped all over the world. Well, when the Jewish settlers that were in Gaza left, they said to the inhabitants, you can have these hothouses. You know, here they are, you can have them, because they were leaving. Do you know what happened to those hothouses? They tore them down and put rocket launchers there. they wrecked them. The inhabitants of Gaza wrecked these hothouses and put missiles in there instead, rocket launchers. Okay. Golda Meir, who was prime minister of Israel in the 70s, made this statement. She said, there will be peace when they love their children, meaning the Arabs, more than they hate us. I think Israel's still doing some settlement in the West Bank. I think it's been curtailed some, but I don't know for sure.
They're
I know it's always an issue.
Not inhibiting it, they're supporting
it. As far as I know, yes. I think I know that there's still an argument that Israel is still doing too much more settlement in the West Bank. And I don't even want to touch that one way or the other. I think I'm going to leave that one too. We'll do some questions and answers tomorrow. I think we got to close here. And we're actually going to segue here. I don't want to leave it too hanging. Again, I think the spiritual solution, what God has to do in the hearts, and especially where there's light, is so huge. Because it's not necessarily going to be solved on the political level. It's got to be solved on another level. So what we're going to do is we're going to transition. just this other connective point here about not business as usual. Okay. See, we're going to go to Oneg, which is refreshments, after Shabbat refreshments, but we're also going to take some bread and some wine. Okay. And you see, Paul says in 1 Corinthians, in reference to communion, he says, as often as you do this, you show the Lord's death until he comes. One of the things that the church has done with communion, and I don't mean to be anti in some way, but the church has made communion a sacred religious rite that happens in the sanctuary. You following me? Okay, it's a religious thing. Well, in Judaism, and I believe when Paul said, as often as you do this, see, in the Jewish community, in Jesus' day, before Jesus' day and since Jesus' day, Melchizedek with Abraham had bread and wine. It goes back a long way. But within the Jewish community, it's an aspect of community. Okay? It's fellowship with one another. It's kind of over the table. It's over a meal. It's over refreshments. It's not in the sanctuary, in the holy place so much as it is in the community place. Okay? And so we're going to take bread and wine because that's what Jewish people do. They take bread and wine. Okay. Holy grape juice. And we're going to just move over to it, and we're going to go right to it. All right?